This is part five of the series of Torah State. It's always sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas, Yonah ben Aryeh Leib. Part five deals with the culture of the Torah State. So the first question we have to ask is there such a thing as culture in Torah? And if so, what is it? So culture refers to, or I refer to by a Torah culture, as the notion of Torah-based art or literature or music or movies or sports, etc. Something that appeals to the mind, but also to the senses. In the Torah state, how do people relax? How do people unwind? How do people enjoy themselves outside the framework of Talmud Torah? Is there such a thing as a Torah form of entertainment? Now the simple, and I dare say prevailing sentiment in many Torah circles today is one big, of course not. Talmud Torah can get kulam. There's nothing in the world that compares to the study of Torah. It says in Sefer Yeshua, Vagiso Yom V'loilo, we reference that in the Ma'ariv every evening, Vagiso Yom V'loilo, you should meditate in the Torah day and night. It's like Gemara Menachos, that Sadi Tesamit Beis. One person asked Rabbi Ishmael, can he learn Chochmas Yevonis? So he said, he was answered, well, the Torah says, Vagisa bo yom v'loilo, say uvdo, go out and investigate. Is there a time which is no, that is not day or night? If you find such a thing, then lamod bo Chochmas Yevonis. What in context refers to Chochmas Yevonis can, of course, just as easily apply to any other diversion or any other recreation. So lechora, at first glance, the primacy of Talmud Torah militates against it. Add to that all the difficulties, especially in the modern world, but the Renaissance was as bad, if not worse, the difficulties of finding appropriate cultural offerings that do not violate the Torah norms of halacha or our sense of decency and propriety, doesn't capture us or seduce us with its allures. Now, for sure, there is such a stream of Jewish thought that perceives any use of free time for non-Torah-based interests as bittul Torah, as a waste of time, a waste of energy, a waste of resources, a cheapening of our purpose in life. Odom le'omol yulod, the pasuk says, man was born to toil, ashrei mi she'amalo b'Torah. Fortunate is the one whose toil is in Torah. And add to that, as I mentioned last month or so, a very pronounced strain of Puritanism in Jewish life that's only getting worse, not better. Puritanism as defined by H.L. Mencken, the haunting fear that someone somewhere may be happy. You may recall that I spoke a number of weeks ago about a few bands that have arisen in Jewish life recently. A concert by Lippa Schmelzer, a Haredi singer, was forced to be canceled on the relatively specious grounds. There's nothing he was doing then that he wasn't doing before. There was a Hasidic actor. How's that for an oxymoron? But there was a Hasidic actor who was forced to withdraw from a movie he was filming with Natalie Portman when he was threatened with banishment from Williamsburg and his children from expulsion from their yeshiva, even though in neither case was normative halacha being violated. So is there a place for personal development of talents, for hobbies, for recreation in a Torah state or in the lifestyle of Torah? At the very beginning of Mesilas Yesharim, the Ramchal writes that Ikar Mitzios HaOdom Ba'olam Hazeh Hurak L'Kayim Mitzvos V'Lavod, the essence of man's existence in this world is solely fulfilling mitzvahs, serving God, v'la'amod b'nisayon, and withstanding the various trials that come our way. But the Ramchal adds that there are hana'os ha'olam, there are pleasures in the world too, and those pleasures are appropriate only if they are adjuncts, ezer v'siyua bilvad, if they assist a person in a service of God by providing him with nachas ruach v'yishuv adas, with contentment, with peace of mind, so he'll be able to free his heart for that requisite service of God. Now this is based on a famous Rambam in the fifth parak of the Shmoneh Prokim. The Rambam says, similarly, although it predated the Ramchal by centuries, all of one's activities have a single goal, Hasagas Hashem Yisbarach, attainment of knowledge of God to the best of the person's abilities. So all of a person's movements and thoughts and activities are all geared to this, whether it's learning or sleeping or eating or exercise. The Rambam references his commentary in Avos in the third parak on V'chol Ma'asecha Yiyu L'Shem Shemayim. All your deeds should be the sake of heaven. Those deeds don't necessarily mean mitzvos. In fact, in a simple shot, it does not refer to mitzvos. V'chol Ma'asecha means everything you do outside the framework of mitzvos. Those should be L'Shem Shemayim for the sake of heaven. So Rambam notes there in parak Hay of the Shemone Prakim, he says, a person's main pursuit is Talmud Torah, but ki hanefesh tileh v'ta'achor hamachshavah v'asmodas iyun hadvar ma'achorim. Man's soul is going to weary, and his thoughts are going to become clouded with a constant, intense pursuit of the intellectual, just like the body tires after the prolonged lifting of heavy objects. It's like the body has to rest, so too the mind has to rest. So for example, he says, Chazal in the Shir, at the beginning of this year, sometime would offer a milsa dibidichusa. They would tell a joke to lighten the mood, to engage people's minds. Or the Rambam says here, Menuchas HaChushim, resting one's senses by looking at tsirim, looking at pictures. Pictures of buildings, pictures of objects, all this as a means to an end, to rest one's mind for the purpose of Torah. So indeed there's a value to this pastime. It doesn't take much to extrapolate from the siyurim of the Rambam's time to other pictures that people look at today in order to rest their minds or entertainment purposes, all of which we'll discuss. Now admittedly this is a tough sell today, because indulgence in the popular culture is used, for example, by modern Orthodox Jews as a key distinction between them and the yeshiva world. It's difficult because of the problem of potentially surim that one falls prey to, and because of the ubiquitous danger that these will not remain diversions, but will become essences, mainstays of a person's life, one's primary pursuit. Not from Torah, or during leisure, not from Torah, but from work. If a person will do his work 8, 9, 10 hours during the day, and then rather than rest his body or mind from work by engaging in Torah, then he'll seek out these means of entertainment. So if the tachlis, if the goal is Torah, then the Torah state has room for, you can even argue, has a need for, culture. So what is that and how is it? Now culture in Hebrew is tarbut. Tarbut's a word you find first in the Torah, in a negative way. People refer to tarbut anashim ra'im. Tarbut is defined, culture is defined as the social, religious, intellectual, and artistic structures that characterize a society. So it takes in a very wide swath. It's the way society develops pursuits, interests, even the propagation of ideas and values in a way that's always very unique to a society. Now obviously in a Torah state, everything is centered on Torah, either directly or indirectly. And since Torah is infinite, a person's leisure pursuits, theoretically, can also be found in Torah. So if we want to first talk about the culture of a Torah state, let's first talk about Torah. Torah is not only Chiddush Reb Chaim Brisker. Torah is very expansive. Torah is Chumash and Tanakh and Talmud and Agadah and Midrashim and Musar and philosophy and Jewish history. More extensively, Surah Masas Vederach HaKrai, but even disciplines of Chochmas Hashem, like science and mathematics, etc., can be encompassed under the general rubric of Torah. So, theoretically, if a person wants to relax from hours spent learning Gemara Erevin, wanted to clear his mind from intensive Torah study, he could find it in general subjects, something else within the world of Torah, something which, so to speak, is lighter, which doesn't require that much concentration or focus. Just as an example, the story in the Gemara of Adazar, Daf Yotes Amad Aleph, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's son, Rabbi Shimon, was learning with Levi. They finished whatever they were doing, and Rabbi Shimon wanted to learn Tehillim, and Levi said he wants to learn Mishlei. And Rabbi Shimon forced him to learn Tehillim. Until they started, and then Rabbi Shimon's father, is giving a shiur, and he darshan the very first pasuk in Tehillim that says, "Kim b'saras," the second pasuk in Tehillim, first parak, "Kim b'saras Hashem chafso," the Torah of God is His delight. So Rabbi darshan, "Ein adam lo mei Torah, ela mimakom shelibo chafetz." A person should only learn Torah, the place where his heart desires. Meaning a person should find an area of Torah, and the Torah is infinite, so everyone can find something in Torah, and some people can find a multiplicity of interests in Torah, but everyone can find in Torah something which catches their minds, their hearts. So Levi heard that, he took out his mishlei and said to Rav Shimon, "I don't have to learn with you anymore. I'm potter because of what your father said." Now while the Gemara may refer to Talmud Torah directly, the point applies here as well. Torah is broad enough that people can find both intense intellectual enjoyment and psychological nourishment in it. There's something for everyone. Now, for centuries, the primary culture of Jews was Torah. As we'll see, there was little else, and much of what there was on the outside was compromised by alien religious values. But the culture was Torah. Never forget a story my neighbor told me once when I grew up in Muncie. He grew up on the Lower East Side, and he said he was a boy of 6 years old walking in one of the streets with his father Shabbos morning after davening, and he looked into a window of a basement tenement, and he saw two people, men, sitting bareheaded, smoking cigars, learning Gemara. And he said to his father, "What is this?" And his father explained to him, "These are maskilim. They don't observe the mitzvos, but to them, Talmud is their culture. This is how they spend their Shabbos. They're smoking bareheaded on Shabbos, but they're learning Gemara." So for Jews, there always was a culture of Torah. You can trust me, I only speculate, but trust me, those guys' grandsons are not learning Torah bareheaded, smoking on Shabbos. Most likely, they've intermarried by now. So therefore, that's not something, culture is not something you can easily pass down to the next generation. As any parent finds out, you can't transmit your taste in music to your child, and vice versa, I should add. So Torah has something for everyone. Now, granted, there is a stream of thought in Jewish life that limits culture to what's described here. Torah and its immediate branches. Most recently, it's reflected in what we would call the Lithuanian tradition, but more broadly to Eastern European Jews generally, as opposed to Western European Jews who are more open to it. In that society, the Eastern European Jews, the definition of Bittul Torah was drawn very, very broadly. Sometimes Bittul Torah even encompassed certain mitzvahs that a person might perform. Rashi would say, "Let someone else do it. You should sit and learn. For you, it's Bittul Torah." Now, part of this was Lishma. He was sincere. Talmud Torah keneged kulam. And part of it was circumstances. For much of European history, at least when Jews interacted with Christians, music and art were primarily church-related. They're Christian-themed. And Jews naturally felt distant from that. The music at first was Gregorian chants and other liturgical music. Art was the painting of saints and other biblical scenes, which is obvious if you visit any European museum. I went to the Hermitage last summer in St. Petersburg, which has one of the largest collections in the world. And their art goes back probably 2,500 years to the beginning of the first Beis HaMikdash, where art was very, in that era, art was very primitive. But almost from the first century on, for the next 15 centuries, every art, every painting that you see is Christian themed. So you just look, you know, others are staring, seeing, to me, you know, look the same. So people just walk by, and that was it. But think about it, 15 years, there was no other theme. That was art. So it's no wonder why Jews almost fell off the map when it came to art, when it came to music, when it came to literature. We felt estranged from that. All of that fell out of our consciousness. That's one price of exile, that it fell out of our consciousness. To that extent, in that tradition that I mentioned, it's still not part of our consciousness. It's still really not part of our world. There is, though, another stream in Jewish life, and in our day, it has been articulated naturally by Rav Kook, who more than any other thinker envisions what a Torah state should look like. So Rav Kook wrote, this is in his Amorim, a nation needs kol kinyanei chomer v'kol kinyanei ruach. A nation to exist needs every area of acquisition, both material and spiritual, every area of development, artists, builders, musicians, poets. A nation needs all of that. He wrote in Arpalei Tohar, every increase in the aesthetic sense of man prepares for us paths, shvilim, paths for the appearance of Aorot El Yonim El Tzar Ruchani El Yon, the appearance of the upper, the supernal light from the supernal source of spiritual delight. That is to say, in language we can understand in English, not just in Hebrew, what culture does, what art and music, etc. does, is it opens the soul and the intellect of man to divine inspiration, because God is the source of all creativity. And without such cultural development, Rav Kook said, a person will reach the lowest level of bizui v'giul, the lowest level of abomination and disgrace. But even Chochma, even the majesty of Musar, even Yiras Hashem, even the fear of God will not be grasped by him. His heart will be closed to it. In exile, it has to be said, Jewish culture faded to insignificance, especially during the centuries of persecution. But even when it was revived, during the Enlightenment, for example, it lost its Torah flavor. In the land of the greatest freedom, the United States, Jews, sad to say, have been responsible to a large extent for a coarsening of American life, for the excesses of American culture, Hollywood, or books, or theater, a very, very exaggerated, extreme view of the First Amendment, which is one which is basically forced into the legal system by Jewish attorneys. In Israel, there's been a greater revival, and the Jewish soul has been unleashed in its artistic creativity, not always virtuously. But what about a Torah state? What does Torah say about general areas of culture? So we'll take up a few, beginning with music. Now, music has returned with a vengeance. Sometimes it's loud enough to be said it's with a vengeance in Jewish life these days, after centuries where it was relatively dormant. Now, clearly, music and song were always prevalent in ancient Jewish life because we were a healthy nation of vibrant people. At Yom Suf they sang, Oz Yosher Moshe. Not only sang, but Miriam and her women brought out their drums and they danced. Who would think to leave Egypt as a slave? They had drums, no, they took their tupim. The Beis HaMikdash rocked with music in a way that we cannot understand. The Levim sang constantly, they played instruments, the Karbonos were accompanied by shir, the Karm Pesach was brought on Erev Pesach amid a raucous and repetitive singing of Hallel. The Beis HaMikdash had on staff conductors, Lamanatzeach, conductors and musicians with inspirational music that drew people to want to experience the Beis HaMikdash. And they came. All it cost was a karbon. That's it. You had to bring a karbon and you could come. Rabbi Wein said once, said many times, very interestingly, he said, I forget from who, but there's a mesorah that the stirring tune, the stirring nigun that we sing for Kaddish before Musaf on the Yomim Noroim. That nigun, he has a mesorah that it's one of the songs of the Levim and the Beis HaMikdash. And now you know why it touches the Jewish soul the way it does. But that was just one. There are hundreds and thousands of songs of Nigunim, and each tunes, melodies, and each generation made others, and they accompanied the Karbanos in a way which was overwhelming to the senses and drew people in. David famously played his harp to soothe Shaul. It's interesting. I don't know. It could very well be true, but I don't know of any Gedolei Torah today who play an instrument, or if they did, would admit publicly to playing an instrument, because of how the world will look on it as a frivolous activity. David HaMelech didn't see it like that. He played it to soothe Shaul, and he played it to gain inspiration for himself. Shlomo's palace, it says in Koheles, was still Sharim Misharot. Male and female singers. I hasten to add, some say the female singers were for the females, entertaining the wives and concubines of Shlomo, who numbered 1,000. In the ancient world also, music was considered a science. Very precise, very ordered, and there is a certain brilliance to it. I was forced to study classical music in college, and at a certain point I started to enjoy it. Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, they were geniuses in the way, it's the same thing with an artist and a white canvas. They just took silence and converted it into a rousing, emotive expression of sound that touched the soul. And they do it not haphazardly. They do it in a way in which, you know, they weave together. It's a variety of things. It almost contains the same chokhmah that goes into the interaction of a pitcher and a catcher during a baseball game. Almost that level. What to throw the batter, where to station the fielders, what count. There's a whole chokhmah to it as well. Music is like that too. And certainly the Gedolim, the Rishonim, noticed that. Rabbeinu Bachya writes in the Chovos HaLevavos, which is one of the great, the first great Musar Sefer. It's 1,000 years this coming, that's the mid-century, 2050. It's written in 1050. Rabbeinu Bachya said, music is one of the great tovos, one of the great benefits that we have in our world that benefit man. The Kuzari writes that music has special significance to Jews, and music itself, like everything else in the physical world, reaches perfection in the Beis HaMikdash, elevating us so that our very natures would change when we heard the music in the Beis HaMikdash. But he says, this he wrote in the 1100s, that music today is no longer respectable. He wrote this 900 years ago. Music is no longer respectable. It's lost its former greatness, like Jews have lost their former prominence. And he said, today's musicians are hamichu arim ibnei adam. They're the ugliest of people. Didn't mean ugly in a physical sense. He meant ugly in a moral, in a spiritual sense. What he'd say about today's, I don't know, but already it's been 900 years downhill. The Gra, the Gaon Mivilna, said famously that without music we cannot understand Tamei Torah, certainly not the Sodos of the Shir HaLeviim. And elsewhere the Gaon was reputed to have said that without music one does not really understand what Kavana is. Because Kavana means harnessing all the powers of the intellect to focus on Tefillah. The only way a person can harness all the powers of the soul is when you have an understanding of what music does. So music is beneficial to the soul, to the mind, and to the body as well. So Mechaber says in Yeradeh, in the laws of Nedarim, Nodra, if a wife takes a vow not to dance, not to sing, not to listen to music, Hevi Nidre Inui Nefesh, these are considered vows of suffering that a husband has the right to nullify when he hears about it. That's how Chazal perceived it. Now, of course, Halacha, like in every area, prescribes the parameters of this as well. So, among the things which changed our attitude towards music and everything else in life was the Churban Beis HaMikdash. After the Churban, we have a klal, it's also to have Shir Al Hayayin, to sing in the presence of wine, except for weddings, at weddings. That's the psak of the Maram Shik. But in Chavadas, in the first chalek, Rav Adya Yosef permits those who want to be lenient to have music for any dvar mitzvah with wine. This is why you have so many popular bands today that play even at Hupsharon. For any time, if there's no wine, if there's no kalas rosh, he specifically permits cholamoy, because music makes a person happy. is a very interesting hakira that is not widely accepted, that many types of music today cannot be banned zecher l'churban because they didn't exist at the time of the churban. You can't ban it. The Rambam has a more restrictive, a more stringent view. He says, based on the Gemara Gittin, Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, Osur L'Nagein B'Klei Shir. You can't play musical instruments at all. But you see from above that Rashi and Tosos disagreed. Others prohibit singing psukim outside the context of davening. That's why you find, for example, Hasidic nigunim that have no words to them. They just sang melodies and not words because of this issur not to attach psukim to music outside the context of tefillah. This is based on the Gemara Sanhedrin of Kuf Aleph Amud Aleph. There the Gemara says, a person who takes a pasuk from Shir HaShirim and makes it into a song, Anila Dodivid Olili is a classic, makes it into a song, like a love song. So the Torah is Chogeres Sack, only time the expression is in the Gemara. The Torah dons sackcloth and complains to Kadosh Baruch Hu, look how Banecha, look how your children are using me, as leitzim, as mockers and scorners, taking the holy words of Torah and using them as entertainment. Rav Moshe Feinstein is a tshuva in the first chelik of Yoredeo in Kuf Ayin Gimel that a person is not allowed to make a pasuk into a song, not even to record it as a song. That's interesting. I guess not every psak of Rav Moshe is followed, but Rav Shlomo Zalman differed, and he said that if the intention is his orus means to inspire people to think about the meaning of the pasuk, then it's mutter. But Rav Moshe said, no, it's not mutter at all, not to record, not to sing, that's the Gemara. In the Haredi world, so you have in the Mishnah Lachos a number of decrees, modern decrees, that impact on the communities today. Rav Menashe Klein prohibits mixing at concerts. That's where Lippa Schmelzer ran afoul, apparently, towards the end of his career. And he prohibits, very interesting, I never saw this before, he prohibits watching women play instruments. I have noticed the last few years there are some women musicians playing in bands, but he prohibits a man, and they see why it may not exist in the Haredi world, he prohibits a man from looking at a woman who's playing a guitar, an oboe, a clarinet, mishum tenu oseho, because by definition she has to move, but there's always a reason if one wants to say no to anything. Of course, it's forbidden to listen to licentious lyrics, but Rav Aviner, interestingly, permits foreign songs if you like the melody. You don't even know what the words mean. And the words may not be that edifying. But he permits it if you like the melody, because Eina mangina mikabelas tuma. There's no tuma, there's no impurity in a melody. Now, that's not always true. One of the problems that Chazonim always have when they're converting popular melodies to the davening, well, it's not just the words and how they fit, but it's the nature of the song itself. I remember in my shul in Queens, there was an Israeli who would become apoplectic every time one of the Balei Tefillah used Erev Shel Shoshanim in Kedusha. Erev Shel Shoshanim is a relatively licentious piece about two lovers about to spend the night together in the park. That's what it's about. So to sing it, you know, to Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvakos, seems a little incongruous. That's what he's talking about. You be careful. I guess the people do it because they don't know what the words mean. They just like the melody. So they have to say Hebrew is, in this case, a foreign language, as Rav Aviner defined it. They don't know what it means, so they just use the melody. Rav Aviner also said, you're not allowed to listen to the singing, the songs of a Rasha, or a min, an evil person, or a heretic, which basically ends anyone listening to the radio today. Now, in a Torah state, how is one to decide between all these opinions? See, here I think we come to an important klal which applies in every area of life, and certainly in this area. It all depends. I think one of the problems the Haredi world has is rigidity. One of the problems the modern Orthodox world has is fluidity. But one of the problems of the Haredim is rigidity. Because one gadol says something, everybody has to listen. And if a different gadol would have a different opinion, valid also, based on these sources, he'd be afraid to say, because right away you look less from. The fact is, in all these gezeiros, some people may need it, others may not need it. It's certainly possible to say that some things will be banned for certain communities, either because they need the ban or they can't handle the effects of not having a ban. It's permitted to others who are not as affected by it. A healthy community with the respect for authority can determine appropriate limits. But in the Torah world, when you get into the realm of wall posters and mass calling and bullying, so that's no way to run a community and no way to have a psak halacha. Note, very interestingly, the Yerushalmi in Sota in the ninth parak, Yerushalmi says that at first the Emas Sanhedrin, the dread people had, the awe of the Sanhedrin, prevented Nevola Bashir, prevented people from singing obscene lyrics in song. But the Gemara says now there's no Emas Sanhedrin. They don't fear the Sanhedrin. There's plenty of Nevola Bashir. So you have to be careful how much you banned, because once the Emas Sanhedrin is gone, then there are no holes barred anymore, and anything becomes possible. The fact is, the Torah state is impossible to imagine without music, because when the Jewish state and the Jewish people were at their peak in the golden era of Jewish life, music played a very important role in almost every aspect of life, and especially in the Avodas Hashem, the Avodas HaMikdash. Next, art. Yes?
Two quick points. One mention should be made of the Hasidic Rabbonim, who are composers of music.
Yeah, melodies.
Right,
melodies, correct. That's our melodies. That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Is the name to mention, which you might not have heard of, called Joseph Erlich. I don't know if you've heard the name. He is a great musician. Many records today from by different singers. In any case, he was also a gadol, at least a well-known kamatzachim.
Right. Okay.
One example of a accomplished musician.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I never heard of him, but Rav Yom Tov Erlich. Where did he live?
He originally stole a cousin.
Yeah.
From Europe, he lived in Williamsburg for many years. Most recognized in the scholar community.
Okay.
The musician eventually went there to Prague.
Right. All right. I'll take your word for it. Right. The fact is, you know, I'm not talking godless and Torah Chochma necessarily, but we all know all Jewish music rests on Shlomo Carlebach. Without Carlebach, there is no Jewish music even today, because he brought it into Jewish life, and others just stand on his shoulders, developed it after him. And that's why Adayom, he's gone now, it's over a decade already, almost a decade and a half. You'd be shocked how many songs, melodies are still sung that are his. But you see, that was an innovation. In fact, aside from some other exotic aspects of his life, the fact that he brought music back into the Jewish world, so that itself made him an unusual figure. So was there ever art in Jewish life? Of course. Bezalel was a master artist. The Gemara says that's his name. Bezalel Kael was a shadow of God, because such creativity could only have come from God. All the skills that Bezalel had, that he utilized in the Mishkan, were all divine endowments. And the Mikdash of Shlomo, well, there's a whole long parak in Melachim Aleph that describes the years that it took and the intricacies with which they built, and the metalworks and the woodworks, etc. And the Beis HaMikdash of Herod, of Hurdus, which the Gemara says, whoever didn't see the Beis HaMikdash of Herod, Lo Ra'a Binyan Mefor Miyamo, he's never seen a beautiful building, because that's how majestic it was. The type of building, the Gemara says, was all white, white marble. You could see it from miles away. And when the sun shone on it, you could see it from dozens of miles away. Of course, it wasn't beauty for its own sake, but it was beauty to arouse one's senses to be more receptive to the ideas of the Mikdash. But that's what art does. It draws people in by their senses to engage their minds. Now, art has more limitations than music because of the prohibition of Avodah Zarah, idolatry. Depictions of objects of worship, like the luminaries, the sun and the moon, certain animals, men, are generally prohibited. The Gemara discussed at length, the Senyor Day as well. except if it's not perfect, it's not three-dimensional, it's not profile, it's not used for worship, etc. If you look, by the way, over here, you see our little moon, the moon at the bottom and the sun on the top, it's cut into. So it's not, even the moon is not full, it's in three parts, so as not to run afoul, the Shulchan Aruch says. When it came out, I was here with the artist, and I told them to do it exactly like that. And the sun as well is chopped into pieces, so you don't have a full image of the sun. But the halacha is like that. That is to say, the exceptions engendered by the Isser and Azara present very few practical limitations, but they do exist. A perfect statue of a human being might be one. And then I saw that Rav Kook had said to a Jewish artist, a sculptor, that let a non-Jew finish up the face, and then it's not usher anymore. The story that the London Jewish Chronicle 70 years ago, Oberst wrote about Rav Kook, it was after he died, that when he was in London, Rav Kook was exiled. He left Israel in July 1914 for a rabbinical conference. Never go to those. In Europe, and World War I broke out in August, and he couldn't get back till 1919, another 5 years. He spent time in Switzerland, then in London. He became the Rav of a shul in London while he was there. So a sculptor came to him in London to ask if he's allowed to do what he does. And Rav Kook said, as he describes it, the artist, Rav Kook then took down Gemaras and Shulchan Aruch. He was scouring to find a heter for this fellow. And then he said that if it's done imperfectly and named, then it's mutter. So the artist said to him, in that case, minor kusher. He said, how do you know? He said, because my work is far from perfect. That's what he said. Rav Kook, in the same story, the same article, they write that Rav Kook, while he was in London, would frequent the National Gallery with its paintings of Rembrandt. Rav Kook loved Rembrandt, and he told this artist that when he saw Rembrandt's manipulation of light, which, you know, Rembrandts are all over the world. I think there's some of the Met here as well, but you see his famous paintings in Amsterdam and in St. Petersburg as well, and in Florence. Hey, there's a plug. Come to me to Italy. Come with me to Italy July 6th. In Florence also, all of the Italian art, but Rembrandt especially, he had such a unique way of manipulating light that I was first stunned when I saw it. I learned about it in school also, but when I first saw it, just stunning. It's like a blank canvas, and then light and shadows, it's amazing. See, Rav Kook said when he saw the Rembrandt in the National Gallery, he said Rembrandt must be a tzaddik, because the Midrash says that God took the ore of the first day of creation, and that or was nignaz la tzaddikim la osid lofo. He was hidden away for the righteous in the future. He said Rembrandt must be a tzaddik because he saw the genius that he had in depicting that light. So Rav Kook said that people of little faith make the mistake of thinking that those who bring science and beauty into the world are diminishing the sense of the divine in the world. It's really exactly opposite. That's Tod Gedolah. It's a great mistake they make. Those people have an eye in sorrow. They have a very narrow, grudging eye to these efforts. In fact, human creativity is really an expansion. It's a reflection of the creativity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri De'esh, writes, very interesting, the pasuk we say every Friday night in Eish Eschayil, Sheker Achein Vehevel Hayofi, Hevel Hayofi. So Rabbi Weinberg said that only applies to beauty that is outside the boundaries of ethics and religion. That's Sheker Hachein, that's Hevel Hayofi. Then it has no meaning, then it's all vanity. But within the world of Torah, within the world of the ethical population, then it's a glorification of God. Now, in fact, art that glorifies Torah has the capacity to elevate, both in terms of the nation and the individual as well. I was always impressed, my wife less so, there's an artist near the Beit HaRav, off Rehov Rav Kook in Yerushalayim, a Tehillim artist. His mission is to take all the Prakim of Tehillim and paint a picture, a painting, that depicts the essence of that Perek. Very, very vivid colors. That's art, that's Shevach Hashem. Rav Hirsch writes in the 15th of the 19 letters, that there's no artist that's inspired with the true spirit of Torah who would take his chisel or brush to form a work of art that's suited only to stir up impure thoughts and to arouse only the animal in man. The fact is, art has the capacity to do both. But the Torah artist can use it to engage the soul. It's all true, but therein lies the problem. Creativity often involves breaking boundaries, exploring dimensions that no one has before. In a society without restraints, so that will usually involve breaches of sexual norms, like you find in entertainment. It requires that each new creative talent, so to speak, demolish another taboo, as if there's some genius involved and not just pure debauchery. And there's no doubt that art also can be that, as we know. I mean, the fact that artists are trained by painting nudes, so Rav Kook said in other Achronim after that, for a Jew, that's forbidden. Rav Kook saw the dangers, but he also saw the revival of the aesthetic sense of the Jewish people as an obvious sign of the renaissance of the Jewish nation generally. Here's some of his Gadlus a little over 100 years ago. It's the winter of 1907, or the fall of 1907, tough race on the Ches. He was the chief rabbi of Yafo, and he wrote a letter of bracha upon the opening of the Bezalel Academy of Art in Yerushalayim. It still exists now, it's 100 years old. In his Igros, Kuf Nun Ches, so he writes that art is a clear sign of the revival of a nation. And he uses a very interesting mashal. He says, you think of a sickly, feverish young girl who's in and out of consciousness, who's delirious because of her illness. And suddenly she opens her eyes and asks her mother, "Ima, Ima, can I have my favorite doll?" A child who overcomes that illness and asks for her doll, so Cook said, that's a sign that she's recovering and she'll soon be well. And he said, that's Klal Yisrael. Her sick, feverish child couldn't even think of in terms of art. And now that we've returned to our land, 100 years ago, now Jews want to be artists, they want to be painters, they want to be sculptors. That's a sign that the Jewish body has come back to life. So he saw their efforts as a ray of light amid the very thick fog of the dark world that was then filled with spilled Jewish blood, an occasion for great joy. So he took the opportunity to caution them as to halachos, what they can't do. He's against displaying Christian art in Jewish museums or having Yerushalayim altogether. Others were less happy than Rav Kook about the Bezalel Academy of Art, and I think they're even less happier today, 100 years ago, than Rav Kook was. But nonetheless, it's a reflection of what the Gemara says, the pasuk in the Tefillah of Chana, Ein Sur Kelokeinu. The Gemara darshens, Ein Tzayar Kelokeinu. There's no artist like God, no artist. The human artist brings to the surface the latent beauty of God's world, if it's done with pure and not lascivious intentions. Ein Tzayar Kelokeinu. As I mentioned on Pesach during the Shir and Shir HaShirim, discussion we were having in our house, that Jews who limit their clothing to black and white, they're missing something about God's world. God created a colorful world of blues and greens and browns. It's a kaleidoscope. A person wants to dress peshito just in black and white, they're missing something, because that's not the way the world was created. Had God wanted to create a black sky and a white earth, he could have done that too. But Ein Tzayar Kelokeinu, that part, that creative, that yetziratit that exists in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he conveyed to us as well. And that's the way he wants us to live too. Yes?
On the
Tachash, Alim Rasecho? Sosanochi was? Oh, my colors, right? That's a different, it's a colorful world. So we should appreciate the colors of the world. What about literature? So literature is very sensitive. Sensitive because we have the greatest literature at our disposal. It's the Book of Books, the Tanakh. On a simple level, as I noted earlier, midrashim, parables, stories, even if they contain a profound message for Tamid HaChachamim, so they were the literature for the masses. We shouldn't look beyond that. The midrashim were written for the common people. Granted, there are deep ideas in them, But the Midrashans, like the Ein Yaakov, they're stories that people should be able to embrace and get an idea from. That's why they were there. That's literature of a healthy nature. Secular literature for Jews has been bashed, especially in the last two centuries, likely because of the Haskalah. Haskalah gave a bad reputation to any type of foreign literature. There were generations of Jews, it's hard for us to imagine, but there are generations of Jews for whom reading European novels exposed them to a world that was unknown and therefore suddenly seemed alluring. Again, it's hard for us to imagine today reading Anna Karenina or A Tale of Two Cities or War and Peace and someone who's swept away from the world of Torah. But nonetheless, you know, that's what it was in terms of novels and poetry. It happened because they saw there's more to the world than their shtetl and suddenly had a great desire for that world, like the sons of Noah when they left the ark after the Teva. Actually, people don't read that much today altogether, so maybe that's why it's not such a big problem anymore. Now, literature as a genre was almost unknown to Jews. Jews who could read learned Torah. Those were the educated classes. You see, from the Gemara, not every Jew could read. That's why there's Shlich Tzibur. Not every Jew went to Shul. That's why they prayed to the Amshad Sodos, etc. There was tremendous respect for those who could, tremendous respect for the written word. The Rambam says, too much respect. He says in the Mora, something that we should take to heart today, the ancients will believe anything if they see it in writing. If someone writes it, it has to be true. There are people still like that. Thus, you had one famous case in the 19th century, a Talmud Chacham wrote the historical novel called The Niflos of the Golem of Prague, The Wonders of the Golem of Prague, and people took it literally. And some take it literally until today, because that Talmud Chacham also wrote Svarim. He is was the grandfather of Mordechai Rickler, the Canadian novelist. He went from Europe to Canada. He did. Yudel Rosenberg was his name. So he wrote a historical novel, and people took it literally. Until today, people take it and think the Golem existed. The story of the Golem, did not enter the Jewish world until three centuries after the Maharal Miprag died, because it was based on a novel. Undoubtedly, Jews were exposed to novels in the secular world as well. So much so, the Mechaber says in Ar Chaim, in Shin Vav Sif Tezayin, on Shabbos, for example, it's also to read general interest novels. Jewish history is allowed. The Ramah permits general interest works if it's in Hebrew, but Mechaber bans Divrei Cheshek, Kigon Sefer Emmanuel, romantic, erotic novels like the Book of Emmanuel. What that book is, I don't know. It's not in Barnes & Noble anymore. But those books apparently stimulate the Yetzirah, so it's always forbidden. Mechaber adds that those who write them or copy them and publish them, they're machtim es harabim. So there was that literature. But literature can also be edifying as well, raising ideas and stories and values in a positive light. So for sure, there's been an explosion of Torah-based literature in the last 25 years, both in Israel and the United States, even beyond the generic and somewhat hackneyed stories and miracles of Gedolei Torah. But nonetheless, there is a literature developing. I confess, I myself almost never read novels. I read nonfiction. For fiction, I read the New York Times. Now, Rav Kook saw literature as valuable. Valuable. He said it broadens the mind, and especially, listen to this, he had such a keen eye. Literature, he meant novels, not nonfiction. Literature enables a person to see the world, to see life elsewhere, to see different societies without actually visiting them, but rather through words that create mental images. He said, through literature, you get to stand in someone else's shoes and experience life and events through the eyes of another person. And that way, we shape our own perspectives and expand our own horizons. The brilliance of a Gadol b'Torah who saw not a narrow part of the Torah system, but the entirety of the Torah system. Of course, he said, when we speak about our perspectives and horizons, it has to be Torah. So it has to be holy. In the Perek Lamed Vav of Orot, Rav Kook said, he wrote that the Safrut Yisraelit, the Israelite, the Hebrew literature cannot succeed without hitkatshut haneshamot shel hasofrim, without the sanctification of the souls of the writers, of the authors. So a Jewish author, a Torah author, who's writing novels, he has to purify his midos, he has to refine his deeds and his thoughts, so his imagination will reach the upper spheres and not the lowest spheres. And when that happens, Rav Kook said, literature and authors will be sanctified, and the world itself will be exalted enough to recognize the power of literature, and all that will uplift the spiritual state of the world. Rav Kook also saw poetry as the same thing. I don't think poetry is as popular today as it was, say, 50 or 100, 150 years ago. Rav Kook saw poetry as a means to express ideas that were too sublime to be written in prose, or emotions or feelings that were too vivid to be captured in prose. So Rav Kook was a prolific poet, and most of his poems are still extant. Some of his poems are all beautiful. Some talk about Avos Hashem. Others are more tachlis. We studied here in Shul, must be 2-3 years ago, on Chanukah, a long poem that Rav Kook wrote in rhyme that describes the story and all the halachos of Chanukah, including paskening between different shittos, all in rhyme. That was one of his poems that we studied. Here's a prolific poet, as were, by the way, the Gedolei Sfarad. Again, it almost died out completely in the Eastern European milieu. So much so, think about it. You open a book of Zmiros for Shabbos. Where the Zmiros from? Almost all from Spain. How could it be that in 900 years there's not one Zemer came out of Eastern Europe? It'd be. There's not one Zemer I know of that came out of Eastern Europe that's found in your in our Zmiris books. It's all from the Sephardic culture, which had Sephardic culture from Spain, but also Caribone, of course, that's from Yisrael. Nadja was the Rav in Gaza in the 1500s. But aside from that, nothing. It was just, they were completely divorced from that world of literature and the poetry. The Chassam Sofer, though, also wrote poetry, although the Hungarians will deny it to this day. Now, Rav Kook also saw value in sports, and he praised, also in a wrote, in Lamed Gimel, Lamed Dalid, praise of all things soccer players. He saw Jewish youth, not religious, playing soccer, and he praised it. He said, look, young people strengthening their bodies and their spirits, the shil gvurata uma bichlala, for the sake of the strength of the nation as a whole. That's Avodah HaKodesh, that's holy work. For that conclusion, of course, he was lambasted by the old Yishuv, who saw it all as Bittul Torah. Rav Kook saw its value, not as an essence, but as a means for some to keep in shape and keep their spirits up while engaged primarily in more noble pursuits. But for other people, like these, that's Gvurat HaUmah. That's the means through which they will make their contribution to Jewish life. Finally, let's look at entertainment generally. So sports, as Rav Kook said, is a good means, but it's a diversion. What happens if one transforms this diversion into a primary pursuit? So that's a waste of time, and that's Bittul Torah. I mentioned to the teens a few weeks ago, listening to the two of the great Bali Musa today, Mike and the Mad Dog, a few weeks ago on a Friday, and they said, we have a busy weekend ahead of us. So I'm thinking to myself, a busy weekend, sports is a diversion from what you're supposed to be doing. By saying the whole weekend is dedicated to it, you've confused, you've transposed what's the essence and what's secondary. So that's life. I guess for them it's a business. More to the point, sports is a form of entertainment, especially for spectators. It's just a form of entertainment. So I mentioned to my wife, we're in Israel a few months ago, it was an incident with the soccer team, Beitar Yerushalayim. They were playing a game on the anniversary of Rabin's assassination, and it was in Haifa, and instead of observing the moment of silence, they started cheering the fact that he was killed. So for that, Beitar Yerushalayim was penalized that they had to play two home games in an empty stadium. So I'm thinking to myself, the whole purpose of sports is to entertain the spectators. When you say you're going to play the games in an empty stadium, Basically, you said the purpose of the game is for itself. It's an end in itself. The fans want to come, let them come. But we'll play anyway. Made no sense. But you see, maybe it's not so. Maybe it is an end in itself. Television, radio, movies. So these today are lightning rods. They're dividing lines for Jews. They're defining characteristics for many modern Orthodox Jews. I was once with a group of Rabbanim, and I said to them, tell me, how would you define modern Orthodoxy? So one of them said, well, the modern Orthodox should go to movies. I said, well, you can't make a whole religious movement based on the principle that you go to a movie. That's not a religious principle. But nonetheless, that's a reference that people use that comes out very quickly. It's very handy also for shidduchim these days. Do you go to movies? Do not go. You have a TV? You don't have a TV. Is the radio? Which stations do you listen to? What does it all really mean? The fact is all of them occasionally can involve potentially surim, similar to the automobile or the telephone, which also can involve potentially surim. So the question is, from a normal perspective, how do you harness these mechanisms for holy purposes? Now, Rav Moshe said, writes in Or Chaim Bei, Chelek Bei's Ayin Tes, that movies are completely forbidden as leitzonos, frivolity, and for the regular exposure to the viewer of sins, like arayos, like homicide, which just cheapens life. In fact, in a study showed today that a child watching television from age 5 to 20, they'll be exposed like 35,000 homicides during their lifetime, people being killed in front of them. And he said, even if a particular movie is not, it's a mikre, it's a coincidence. But the truth is, these entities are morally neutral. They're like a person's mouth. You could say things which are uplifting and noble and things which are not. What is their power and influence? Radio, television, film, internet. It could be harnessed to spread Torah, to expand the person's horizons like literature used to do, to provide even those tsirim that the Rambam spoke about, tsirim of binyanim na'im, things which relax the mind, to clear a person's head from the day's learning and to reinforce good values and midos and ideas. The fact is, you just go through Tanakh, you could depict stories in Tanakh, and they're better than anything that a screenwriter could produce today, because wild things happen in Tanakh, and all of them have a moral to it. So this is a work in progress, again, because of a natural reluctance, for the variety of reasons I mentioned earlier, for religious Jews to embrace entertainment. You remember in Shul, we showed a few years ago some of the works of the Na'aleh Film School in Israel, a film school of religious Jews who produce on religious or Musar themes. I thought it was very well done. We showed four films here. You can have radio and television networks that are devoted to elevating, uplifting messages and holy programming like you have. You already have today in certain segments. There's always a danger, Rav Kook said, that we'll focus on the kankan and not Masha Yeshbo, that it becomes an end in itself, that all these distractions will become the focus of a person's life. There is that danger. But Rav Soloveitchik said, Yemei Zikaron, that Judaism values beauty and aesthetics, but knows that Yofi doesn't always go hand in hand with Kedusha and Chesed. Sometimes it's antagonistic. Sometimes Yofi can overwhelm a person until it becomes a life of holiness, of frivolity, in that one goes to work, and work is what he does, and his leisure time is television, is entertainment. And Torah enters his life, but sporadically. And what is Chayenu, Baruch Yomeinu, our lives, the length of our days, becomes secondary, becomes tertiary, if that. Culture is designed to add color and spice and variety to a person's life. So part of the Torah state is trying to create a new culture. Like it's a big part of Israeli life today. Not that Israeli culture is necessarily Jewish or Torah oriented, but nonetheless, Israel, by the way, today per capita produces more books than any other country in the world. They're a nation of voracious readers, but at the very least, voracious purchasers of books that they keep on their mantles. People today, Rav Bar-Ilan writes, have a very strong desire for cultural pursuits, much more than in past generations. for a variety of reasons. We have more free time. We have more free time today. Work in that sense is easy because of all the appliances. And if you have more free time, we have more opportunities for a variety of forms of entertainment. So we live in more densely populated areas, so we interact much more with each other. And he says also importantly that you can't suppress it, because if you suppress too much, people will find what's asur if they don't find what's mutter. And that also happens with Davonena today. The Rambam says in the Mora, in the third Chelek, one of the 14 activities of the human being is Pulat HaSchok. Pulat HaSchok means playful activities, which he says are permissible if necessary or if there's a great benefit. What's the benefit? So the Meiri says this in Erevin, Daf Samechemet Aleph, whatever is done for an honorable purpose, for example, L'Sameach Atzmo, to gladden the person so he'll have a da'as tzulah, he'll have a clear mind, not for hololus, not for anot, a clear mind, he can do what he wants to do, so that's tov olav bracha. He should be blessed, but one can't be rodate after it. If you're rodate, then it means you are succumbing to it. Rav Kook writes in the Ein Ayah in Brachos, Harchavat da'at ha'adam adei pinuk chushov, broadening a person's mind through pampering his senses in moderation is very good. It's very good for a person. So this will be a challenge to the Torah state. One further point, culture as it affects the individual. So we spoke about its effect in the nation, but it's important to add, and it's a very important point, Jews value creativity and individuality. Rav Kook said, a Jew is called upon to serve God al pi shoresh nishmato. Like the rabbis say, you can't be a parrot. You can't just mimic what someone else does. You have to go into your soul. What moves you? What contribution do you want to make? And every soul is unique. So Rav Shechter quotes the Rav in the Nefesh HaRav that a Jew has to lead the most. He has to imitate God. To imitate God, God's unique. To imitate God means to be unique, to develop one's own special talents, to express every unique facet of one's personality and direct it to Avodas Hashem. One who does that, certainly in Torah, but also in the arts and sciences and music, is fulfilling the Ratzon Habore, God's will. The Rav said in Ish Halacha, Chidush HaYotzer, the innovation of the creator, the creative spirit, that is the essence of Torah. So therefore, the Torah state and its leadership must never try to stifle the creative impulses that Jews have, and must find ways to allow Jews to enjoy life, of course according to the Torah, but to enjoy life. So the Jew who can paint and sculpt and draw and write and sing and doesn't because he's told that it's asur, will either go off the derech or he'll be a very unhappy and unfulfilled Jew on the derech. To the extent that one requires this is very individualized. It's like food. Some people eat a lot, some a little. Some people need a lot of culture, some need a little culture. One size does not fit all. But the Torah state, when it's reestablished in Heir B'Yameinu, will enable the full expression of all the creative talents of the Jewish soul for the betterment of the society and for the individual, so we should be able to serve God, as the Torah says, B'simcha u'b'tuv levav me'rovkol. I thank you very much. Next week we conclude this most interesting series with part 6, and that is law and minority rights. How does the Torah deal with the rights of minorities, whether non-Jews or dealing with women's issues and other such interesting topics? That's next week. Thank you very much.